I will make a couple of comments before I get started on today's presentation, today's slideshow. And I'll make those comments in spite of the fact that today's slideshow is too long before I ever start. I tried to limit myself on creating these to about 15 slides per day, figuring that that with the talking that I would be doing from slide to slide, that would be more than enough for the most part. And today I've got 18 slides in the show. So at the very outset, I won't be able to probably talk about everything that will be on just what I put up in front of you. I didn't in the young adult class. I only got through 14, and that wasn't necessarily a good place to quit, but that was the way it was. Yesterday and previously, I've had a number of questions about sources and documentation, and I have a couple of photocopied articles that I have with me, and I'm going to just set these on the table up here along with the things that Jerry has brought for you to look at. One of them about the Silver Scroll, but it doesn't have a lot of the information that I was sharing because a lot of that came from the mouth of the archaeologist. I have been privileged to go to several seminars involving archaeologists that do the field work over in Israel and to not only listen to what they say, but to record it and review it later on, and that's true of the story of the Silver Scrolls. Susie and I listened to that on our way back up here on Thursday morning to remind me of some of the details of what went on in that dig. And I have a couple of the articles relating to the Baruch bulla that was on the screen as well. And I'll leave those up there if anybody wants to look at them, then you can do that. They don't necessarily have the same correlations in them that I was drawing because I wanted to connect them very strongly with biblical ideas, biblical teachings, biblical events, although some of those things would be there. Not for anything other than your personal use, of course. Also, we have sitting up here these items that Jerry brought in. I'm just going to comment about one of them. I'm going to take the risk of handling it and hope that I don't have to replace it. But we have this lamp that Jerry brought in to share with us, and the lamp is from about the time of Christ, plus or minus a century, basically. And we mentioned yesterday in connection with the Silver Scrolls that there were a number of lamps and little juglets, really smaller than the one that's here, that were found in that dig. And if you look at the black and white reproductions of the article there about the Silver Scrolls, you'll be able to tell rather darkly, because the photocopied picture isn't very good, but you'll be able to tell rather darkly what some of the lamps looked like that they took out of that cave. And they look very different than this, because lamp technology changed a lot over the centuries. The kind of lamp that they were using in the 7th and 6th centuries BC was a lot simpler than this lamp. Now, this may look very simple to you, but it was a lot simpler than this lamp. It was made basically by turning a bowl on a potter's wheel and then squeezing together one side of that bowl to make a sort of spout. But it was an open spout. It wasn't a closed spout. So you had basically a small open bowl with one side of it squeezed to form a little bit of a spout. And you would lay the wick in that squeezed spout. Now, this one has a little hole for the wick. And I guess it's, you know, a little more fire safety with this kind of design, as well as being able to keep your oil a little cleaner. Someone was surprised about the size of the lamp, but bear in mind that, for one thing, the oil was expensive. You didn't make a great big blaze of a fire to have your light. This wasn't something that you were going to work all night with as a general rule. It was something to give you a little bit of light in the midst of the darkness. But basically, when it gets dark, you go to bed. You know, lamps are for special purposes and not for sitting around for hours on end watching late night television or whatever it might have been. So the fact that oil is a valuable commodity, you want something that is going to take a small reservoir of oil, because oil will also go bad if you just leave it sitting out. It'll start collect bugs in it and things like that, and becomes rather unsavory. So you don't want a container that's going to hold a lot of oil. But you can see how this one, being a high-tech modern version from the first century BC or AD, even has a little handle molded into it so that you can carry it, and this is more or less the kind of lamp that Jesus is talking about when he talks about the 10 virgins, the wise and foolish virgins, a lamp very much like this. And I think you can appreciate that you would not put enough oil in that to burn all night. Okay, that's actually part of the whole idea of the story, is that the lamp itself didn't hold all that much oil. But moving on from that, we are talking about God's incredible book. You'll notice the title has been changed to suit the lesson that we're having today. If you don't know what I'm talking about, either you weren't listening yesterday or your memory's short, and that's okay. God's incredible book. We've already talked about, just very briefly, everything we're doing is very briefly. We've talked about some Greek texts that demonstrate to us that the New Testament has been accurately transmitted from very early times, from the times of the apostles. We have a little scrap up here from a papyrus from about 125 AD of the Gospel of John, a portion of John chapter 18, which reminds us that, in fact, the New Testament was written in the first century and was circulated, this piece coming from Egypt, it was circulated widely by the early second century. We also talked a little bit about the text of the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, the scrolls that they used. We talked a little bit about the Masoretic text, of which we have a copy going back 1,000 years, and then the Dead Sea Scrolls, like this scroll of Isaiah, that go back more than 2,000 years, this particular scroll having been copied down in about 150 BC. And we can see that the text of the Bible has been very faithfully preserved, and again, we have confirmation of the antiquity of that text, an antiquity that was further brought to our attention with the discussion of the silver scrolls, two small silver rolls that were found in a 7th century BC tomb from the days of Jeremiah, both of which had the priestly blessing from the 6th chapter of Numbers on them, reminding us of the custom that originated, we don't know just how early, but at least earlier than this, of actually taking literally the words of Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 6 to wear the words of God, the commandments of God, and to regularly rehearse this blessing, this priestly blessing that Moses gave to Aaron. And we talked a little bit about some seals and bulla, some actual written artifacts from the 7th and 8th centuries and even 9th and 10th centuries BC that have the names of biblical characters that are identifiable, including this one that is a seal, or rather a bulla, an impression from a seal, on a piece of clay that was hardened in a fire that has effectively the legal signature of Baruch, the son of Neriah, the scribe, the man who wrote down the book of Jeremiah at the dictation of the prophet Jeremiah. And those are all things that I think are very encouraging, the kinds of things like being able to say, Elisha healed the waters and the spring has still got good water to this day. And these are things of the same kind that say to us that the stories in the Bible are true stories about real people, real events in real time and space. We're going to continue talking a little bit about archaeology in the Bible. We are going to follow a little bit of the notes that you have in the notebook that came from my hand, and we're going to depart somewhat from them as well. Things kind of tend to flow and get remolded as we work on projects like this. But first of all, I would like to ask a question, and you can proffer an answer. We'll see what we can get for this. What is archaeology?
A grave robber with a PhD.
What's that again?
A grave robber with a PhD.
That's an archaeologist. A grave robber with a PhD is an archaeologist. But what is archaeology? Grave robbing. Okay, there we go. Study of the material remains is the way I have it in the notebook, and that's because you can't study what you can't find, right? It is the study of the material remains, things left behind by people of previous generations, people who lived in the past or cultures that existed in the past. But archaeology is the study of the material remains. There are limits and problems that face archaeology as a science and as a discipline. What are some of the ones that you can either think of or pick up off the notebook page if you happen to be looking at it? What are some of the limits and problems that face archaeology?
Wars.
What?
Wars.
Wars? Now, how is that a... It is, but how do you mean that?
It would keep them out of an area.
All right.
They might know of or want to experience
And as a matter of fact, that's a big problem over in the land of Israel and its surroundings. The Sinai Peninsula, which has a lot of stuff that needs to be looked at, has been kind of tough to look at because it keeps changing hands as to who's in control there and what kind of politics go on. The Dead Sea Scrolls, some of those Dead Sea Scrolls came into the hands of Israel in 1967 at the culmination of, that was the Six Days War, right? At the culmination of the Six Days War, when Yigael Yadin, who was an Israeli archaeologist and also a general in the Israeli army, went to the home of the man who had the last of the original seven scrolls in his possession, an antiquities dealer who would not make a deal with the Israeli government. But having won the war, he went to this man's home in Bethlehem because they now had control of Bethlehem and took the scrolls and settled accounts later as to how much the scrolls were worth. But wars do interfere with the process of archaeological research.
Profiteering, politics, and promotion.
Profiteering. See, there's competition. The Indiana Jones movies were a little far out, but not really all that much, as far as some of the actual motivations that go into, in the past 200 years, the past 150 years of what might be called archaeology. There's a lot of competition for getting there first or for obtaining control of certain kinds of artifacts, certain kinds of remains. There can be tremendous reputations made on the basis of things found. Some of this was evidenced in the controversies over the Dead Sea Scrolls before they finally released the last of them for publication in the last few years. People guarding their turf, people guarding their opportunity to make a name for themselves. And always the competition of those who are not PhD grave robbers, but just ordinary grave robbers, who want to be able to get and sell artifacts, who want to be able to obtain old things for the sake of turning a simple profit on them. So those things also come into play. What else? Dean?
Ignorance. Breaking the stuff up.
Okay. People not handling things right. And also another kind of ignorance, which is even on the part of those who are the professionals in the field, not knowing what they're dealing with or where things are. Okay? We also have simple problems of financing. It takes a lot of money to do an archaeological dig. The kind of dig that I was talking about yesterday with the finding of the silver scrolls, that was a very small dig in terms of the area that was involved. And yet, when they got to the place where they knew that that repository down below had some real stuff in it, all of a sudden things got very expensive very quickly because they had to get in a team of real archaeologists, the people who knew what they were doing, to assist in the work. And they had to stay on the site 24 hours a day for days on end until they could get the good stuff properly cataloged and be sure that they really had a handle on everything that was there. Why do you suppose they had to work there 24 hours a day for a week or more?
To prevent
pillaging. Sure, exactly right. This was in Jerusalem. And if they walked away for a taco break, then somebody was going to walk in and help themselves to the stuff that was laying around in there. So they had to stay there and work it until it was done. It's hard to find funding for things like that. A lot of what I have heard when I've been able to go to seminars put on by the Biblical Archaeology Society and other groups do the same thing, a lot of what you hear there when these guys get up to give lectures, they are fundraising. That's why they're there to give those lectures. They are trying to drum up support for people to give them the funds that they need to go back and do some more digging, to go back and do some more field research, because that's what most archaeologists would like to do, is field research, but it's very expensive and the funds to do it are in short supply. So these are some of the limits and problems of archaeology, not by any means all of them, but these are some of the limits and problems that face archaeologists. We're going to think a little bit about what archaeology can or does say about the Bible, but I'm not going to try and give a single complete answer to that. What can or what does archaeology say about the Bible? Oops. Well, I didn't mean to go past that, but it was so slow to come up, I clicked it twice. This is a magazine cover that came to our house in April, and I really appreciated the article, especially since I knew that I was working on this series of lessons to share with you here. This is a Newsweek magazine, and it asked the question, who were the first Americans? And I don't know, the copy that I made there to put up in front of you is not a very good copy, and the scanner and the newsprint on the front of that cover didn't align with one another just perfectly, but I didn't bother to try and clean it up. A new scientific war over a 10,000-year-old puzzle. Well, I'll leave the 10,000-year-old part to Rick to talk about tonight, since he's doing the age of the Earth there. But I'm not saying that that's right. I don't think it is. That's not really what I'm going to get into today. But the fact is, there are a lot of questions that are hanging out there about things that people thought were nailed down. And that was my point in bringing this to your attention. I don't know how many of you have been to school recently enough or read things recently enough to know that for years they thought they pretty well had it nailed down how the Native Americans got to this continent. And it involved a progress over a land bridge from Siberia to Alaska, basically, over the Bering Straits. It involved several climactic factors. And they thought they had this all figured out, that about 10,000 years ago, the earliest immigrants came to this continent and settled in. And so, whenever they came to a level, basically, where they found remains that seemed to be remains of those earliest immigrants from 10,000 years ago, they didn't look for anything else, because they knew that they were at the beginning. And lately, some archaeologists have dug a little deeper. Some finds they have found by accident, and some finds they found because they said, well, I wonder if there is anything under here. And they are turning up things that were here before those people that supposedly came over the Bering Straits about 10,000 years ago or whatever. I don't think the 10,000 years. In fact, I have my own theory on this, and just so you can know how wacko I am, I think there have been people in the Americas ever since the Tower of Babel incident, basically very shortly after the Tower of Babel incident. And there have been various waves of immigration of people coming to this continent at different times. That's the kind of frame of reference that I actually come from on this. And I think that some of the stuff they're finding now may lend itself to that interpretation. But they are finding the remains of people. They have found about six of them so far, widely scattered, not in one place, people in different places, New Mexico, Washington, different places, whose bones don't seem to match Native Americans, and yet who are coming from a deeper level, a level lower than that which is anticipated as the beginning level for Native Americans. Now, this is a very hot political topic, because we have rights that have been all ground out through tremendous litigation and difficulties of what is to be done whenever Native American remains are found. And these laws get in the way of doing this kind of research, because they dig up these bones of a guy that they call Kennewick Man up in Kennewick, Washington. It's the Army Corps of Engineers that finds these bones, and the Army Corps of Engineers knows that according to the law, when you find old bones, you turn them over to the local Indian tribes. The problem is the anthropologists on the site say, hey, these don't look like Indians. I don't think we have Indians here. And so they don't know what to do. And so they turn it over to the Forest Service, and the Forest Service doesn't know what to do. And so the archaeologists decide that they're going to have to go to court to get the right to even look at these bones and try and figure out what it is that they've actually got a hold of. And there's a real hot political issue. Well, what's going on with archaeology here in America in terms of these early controversies about who really were the first Americans, and how did this process of settlement in what we call America today take place? Those kinds of political issues are a normal part of the experience of archaeologists in the land of Israel. I'm going to mention up here shortly the Ebla tablets, which come from a place in Syria. When the Ebla tablets turned up in 1974, they were a huge political hot potato, because Syria didn't want anything to do with vindicating the Bible and having anything that seemed to connect itself to Jewishness. And so it was a real hot potato on how the archaeologists were to interpret and handle the information that came into their hands with those particular tablets. And those kinds of issues come up all the time. You find something in Jordan that has to do with Israel, what do you do with it? How do you interpret it? How do you publish it? These problems are problems that we need to appreciate, because archaeologists don't always, in the first place, have an interest in finding the truth. And in the second place, even if they do have the interest, they don't always have the freedom to simply put the truth out there of what they believe they have found, of what they think they have seen. So there are problems associated with archaeology, quite a few problems that we need to appreciate, including the simple fact that this is not an exacting science. There is a lot of interpretation involved in the conclusions that archaeologists come to. So, archaeology and the Bible. Archaeology seldom proves things. We should realize that. I have not tried to offer you in my discussions in the past few days archaeological proofs of things, but rather what I consider corroborating evidence, things that support but don't necessarily prove biblical accounts. It is very difficult for archaeology to prove things. It would be very difficult for archaeology working in this country, for archaeologists to prove things about George Washington, for example, who only lived about 200 years ago. It's very difficult using the material remains of the past to prove things. What you find is generally going to be some kind of evidence. It may provide evidence. And we need to bear in mind one of the mantras of archaeology, that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. If you can't find something when you are looking through the remains of old things, that doesn't prove it was never there. It only proves that you didn't find it. But archaeology can provide substantiating evidence, but that evidence must be interpreted. And that's where one of the big challenges come in. Evidence must be interpreted. If you've ever been on a jury, then you may have some idea of the challenges that are involved in trying to determine the truth from the presentation of evidence. You're presented with evidence as a juror, and then it's your job, your responsibility, to figure out now what really happened. What happened? And to render a verdict based on your conclusion about what happened. One of the things that archaeology can do very well is to clarify or illuminate. And that's something that I especially appreciate about it. And that's a big part of what I was trying to share with you in talking about, for example, the Silver Scrolls and the bulla associated with Baruch, with the name of Baruch, the son of Neriah. That illuminates to us a lot of truth in the Bible. It isn't that it's new truth. It's that it helps us to put in perspective some of the things that are already there in the Bible, as well as to have a sense of confidence that this goes right along with the biblical account. That this is perfectly consistent with the biblical account. So archaeology may clarify or illuminate. Now there's a picture of a metal ball up on the screen right now. And we're going to take a look at just what that metal ball is. I'd like for you to open your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 13. 1 Samuel chapter 13, verses 19 through 22. Just take a quick look at that account. I don't have a King James Version up here, so I'm not going to try and read what the King James says there. But basically the gist of the account in 1 Samuel chapter 13, verses 19 through 22, we're told that among the Israelites there were no blacksmiths, right? So they couldn't make any tools of their own, because the Philistines were afraid that if they were able to make tools, they would also make weapons. So they had gun control. They had weapon control here. The Israelites could not have the technology to build weapons. No blacksmiths. And then we are told, if you're reading in your King James, we're told that even though they didn't have any blacksmiths to sharpen their mattocks and their axes and their scythes and all this, that they had what? Anybody with a King James, what did they have?
A file.
Now, I'll have to admit to having read that as a youth and thought, well, this is kind of weird. First it says they can't sharpen them, and then it says they can sharpen them.
What verse is this?
1 Samuel chapter 13, the whole passage is 19 through 22. Verse 21 is the verse where the King James says, nevertheless, they had a file. Our question is, what is a PIM? If you're looking at an NIV, you probably already know what a PIM is now. What is a PIM? Because that's the word that the King James Version says is a file. Everyone had a file to sharpen their tools with. But again, and as I would read that, it would seem to me that that was kind of a strange wording. And until very recently, it was a wording that we were a little bit stuck with, because nobody knew just what a PIM was. This is not a word that you find all over the place in the Hebrew Bible. And it's a word whose meaning was lost over time. But an archaeologist named William Deaver dug up a little metal ball. And it had these two letters scratched on the surface. These two letters were engraved on the surface of it. The Hebrew letters, equivalent to P and M, identifying this as a PIM. A PIM is a weight. In fact, it is about an eighth of an ounce of a weight. This isn't a very big thing. But that weight corresponds to a price. If you put that on the scale on this side and an amount of silver on the scale on this side, then you have a price in silver that you would pay for getting your tool sharpened. Now, it isn't that the King James translators translated it wrong. It's that they didn't have anything to go by. When they got to that word pim, they didn't know what to make of that word. And so they asked themselves the question, the context here is sharpening tools. Now, what would you need to sharpen a tool? Well, file is about the best guess you can make. But this is a place where, in a very insignificant way, but nevertheless a way that, once again, goes right along with the fact that this ancient text from Samuel, with a word that was lost to history until Bill Deaver was doing some digging in Hazor and turned up with this little tiny item that had been long since forgotten, that the word that is there, which the people copying it lost track of what the word even meant, is the right word for what was taking place at the time. The people copying it didn't know what they were copying, and yet it was the right word in the right place for what was taking place there. That there was a price that they had to pay if they wanted to have their tools sharpened. A small price, but then it wasn't really about making a dollar. It was really about keeping the Israelites under control. Another example of the kinds of things that we can learn through looking at what archaeology turns up that may illuminate the Bible just a little bit, we have an altar on the screen. And I hope that you can see it well enough to realize that at the four corners of the altar, only three of which are visible because of the way the lighting is set here, on the four corners of the altar there are projections. Now, what are those projections?
Horns.
The horns of the altar. Again, as a child, as a youngster reading my Bible, I would read about horned altars, as in Exodus chapter 27 and verse 2, the bronze altar that they made for the tabernacle and the altar of incense that they made to go inside the tabernacle, both had horns on the four corners of the altar. And this is what those horns looked like, basically, although this is a stone altar, not a bronze or gold altar. This is a stone altar, but not only this one, but numerous other altars that have turned up in the lands of the Bible demonstrate what is being described when it talks about the horns of the altar. And we read in the book of 1 Kings about Solomon ascending to the throne, becoming king, and how Joab, the former commander of David's army, came under a death sentence, and he went to the place where the temple was going to be. The temple wasn't there yet, but he went to the place where the temple would be, and there was an altar there, and Joab grasped the horns of the altar, and he said, "Kill me here. I'm not going to leave. You're not going to get me out of here. Just kill me right here in this place." And those are the kinds of projections that Joab was grabbing hold of. Now, that doesn't tell us the significance of the horns, but it tells us what we're talking about, what it is that the Bible writers are describing when they mention the horns of the altar. This altar does tell us some other things, because this altar comes from Beersheba. The altar was removed. Well, I'll tell you more about the removal momentarily. It comes from Beersheba, and there are a couple of passages of Scripture that you can look at there. Amos 5 and 5 is one that tells the Israelites, don't go to Bethel, don't go to Gilgal, don't go to Beersheba. The passage is introduced by the Lord saying, seek me and live. Seek the Lord and live. Don't go to Bethel, don't go to Gilgal, don't go to Beersheba. Seek me and live. And he begins and ends the thought with that idea of seeking the Lord and live. At the end of verse 4 in Amos 5, seek me and live. Do not seek Bethel. Do not go to Gilgal. Do not journey to Beersheba, for Gilgal will surely go into exile and Bethel will be reduced to nothing. Seek the Lord and live. What's that telling me about Beersheba? When I read that in the book of Amos, don't go to Beersheba. Don't seek Beersheba. Don't seek Bethel. Don't seek Gilgal. Well, maybe it helps if we know about Bethel. What's at Bethel? What? A golden calf. There's a golden calf at Bethel. Jeroboam put it there. There's a golden calf at Bethel. What about Gilgal? Well, there's a high place at Gilgal. This is the place where Israel first enters the land of promise and where they first celebrate the Passover. And in time, we have a high place at Gilgal. And evidently, because of the grouping of these places that Amos gives us, we have a high place at Beersheba. When we add chapter 8 of Amos in verse 4, 14, chapter 8 and verse 14, Amos says, they who swear by the shame of Samaria, which is to say by an idol, those who swear by the shame of Samaria, or say, as surely as your God lives, O Dan. Now, what's Dan famous for? The other golden calf. Jeroboam set up two of them, one at Bethel and the other one at Dan. As surely as the God of Beersheba lives, they will fall, never to rise again. So Dan and Beersheba are the same. Bethel and Beersheba are the same. The idolatry that's taking place in the one is taking place in the other. Now, it's an idolatry that involves the name of the Lord. They are still using the name of the Lord. But it is an idolatry where God has been supplanted by the images created by men. And so this altar, no reason why you should be surprised, since I already brought up Beersheba, this altar comes from Beersheba. This altar was found at Beersheba and gives us a little bit of insight into the practices of idolatry that Amos was speaking against. When we go on just a little further from the time of Amos, because Amos was speaking early in the second half of the 8th century, we come to the story of Hezekiah. Late, I don't know what century I just said, but it's 8th. Did I say 8th? Early in the second half of the 8th century. That's a good way to put it. That's what I said, I think. When we move a little further down the line in the 8th century, we come to the story of Hezekiah, King Hezekiah. Does anyone remember what sort of a fellow he was? He was considered to be a good king. And when we look at the story of Hezekiah, jumping into the middle of it in 2 Chronicles chapter 30 and verse 5, 2 Chronicles chapter 30 and verse 5, Hezekiah had decided to celebrate the Passover. And he decided that he would try and get everybody that he could to participate in that Passover. And so it says in 2 Chronicles 30 and 5, they decided to send a proclamation throughout Israel from Beersheba to Dan, calling the people to come to Jerusalem and celebrate the Passover to the Lord, the God of Israel. It had not been celebrated in large numbers according to what was written. So they sent messengers all the way to the north to Dan and all the way to the south to Beersheba for people to come and celebrate the Passover of the Lord. When that was over, in chapter 31, verse 1 of 2 Chronicles, when all this had ended, the Israelites who were there went out to the towns of Judah. They were full of zeal that day. They went out to the towns of Judah, Beersheba being one of those towns of Judah. They smashed the sacred stones and cut down the Asherah poles. They destroyed the high places and the altars throughout Judah and Benjamin and in Ephraim and Manasseh. After they had destroyed all of them, the Israelites returned to their own towns and to their own property. This altar was dismantled. It was not found as a complete altar. They were doing their archaeological dig work. They were excavating. They noticed some stones in a wall, and the wall was from the 8th century BC, the time of Hezekiah. They noticed these stones in the wall that seemed to have been worked. There were older stones than the other stones that were accompanying them in the wall. And so they took them apart from the wall and reassembled them to come up with this altar. So the conclusion of the archaeologist, which is only a tentative conclusion, you can't prove that this is the case, it's only a likelihood that fits the scenario, is that this altar was a part of that place that Amos was decrying, that Amos was speaking out against in Beersheba. And that this altar was taken apart, was removed from its usage in Beersheba during this reform that took place in the days of Hezekiah. That this not only illuminates the text as to what we're talking about with a horned altar, but it also goes right along with, fits right in, hand in glove, so to speak, with what Amos has to say about the goings-on at Beersheba, and with what we're told Hezekiah was doing, and those people who were roused by the zeal of Hezekiah to turn again and serve the Lord, and to demolish the high places throughout Judah and even into Israel. We're going to take a step to a very different era here. There is a tablet on the board. Somebody asked me how big the tablet would be, and it would be something that you could hold in your hand. This would not be a huge, monstrous thing. I mention that because a lot of times when I see depictions of the Ten Commandments, the tables of stone, They're pictured as these things that Moses can just barely manage to carry. I doubt if they were like that, because they don't have tablets like that I know of. They have monuments like that, yes. Monuments, but not tablets. Tablets are generally something that you can hold in your hand. They wouldn't be any bigger than a book that you might carry around and read. And I really doubt that the tablets that Moses carried down the mountain were any bigger than that either, but that's neither here nor there. It's just an aside that I felt like throwing out. We have these tablets, which this particular one was pictured and reported in Time magazine September 21st, 1981. And the listing under it says it's a typical Ebla tablet. Came from a place called Ebla in Syria. And I already mentioned in passing that there were a lot of political complications involved with finding the Ebla tablets in Syria, because nobody in Syria wanted them to be in any way connected with the Bible or with Israel. They absolutely were opposed to having that kind of an outcome. And so that really kind of overshadowed some of the work that was done on them, all the political uproar that surrounded them. These were found in 1974, and they were interesting in a variety of respects. I don't know how many of you have ever heard it questioned. I remember hearing it questioned in my youth, whether Moses could have written the Bible, or whether the written accounts of the things described with regard to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob could have been written down, or whether writing had even been invented at such a time. Those kinds of things seem pretty ludicrous now, but those kinds of things used to be put forth. These tablets, when they were found, thoroughly dashed, and many other things that have been found besides, but thoroughly dashed any sort of confusion or uncertainty on that part, because they were dated to approximately 2500 B.C. And I wish I would have put the word about or approximately in front of the 2500 there. But they were dated to about 2500 B.C., which is to say the time frame of the patriarchs, a little earlier than the story of Abraham. Now, some of the interesting things about these tablets, they are not in the Hebrew language, but they are in a language that shares some things in common with the Hebrew language. In these tablets, we have references to people, not the biblical people, but nevertheless the use of the names of Abraham and Eber and Adam and Eve and Jonah and David, as well as a number of others. Now, why is that important? Well, because it says that using the name Abraham in connection with a fellow who lived in about 2000 B.C. makes sense. The name was in use during that time frame, during that particular historical frame of reference. And likewise, there are places named, including Ur, Haran, Sodom, Gomorrah, and Zoar, and there was intense debate about whether the Sodom and Gomorrah and Zoar that were named in these tablets were the same ones that are written about in the Bible in the 18th and 19th chapters of the book of Genesis and the story of Abraham there when the angels came to visit, and then the story of Lot that followed. And we don't have any way of knowing. We just don't have any way of knowing. Sodom, Gomorrah, Zoar are among a lot of cities that are listed as being involved in trade with the people who made these records. But we don't have geographical locations for them. But we do know that the names were in use as names of cities during that period of time, whether they were the same cities that we're reading about in the Bible or not. And likewise, another name that I could have and should have added to this is the name Canaan. The land of Canaan is referred to, and on that one there isn't any question that it's referring to the land of Canaan that we know in the Bible as the land of Canaan. And at least some archaeologists really believe that Sodom and Gomorrah are the same ones as well. But at any rate, the land of Canaan is referred to. And again, there had been those who said, look, the name Canaan, this word Canaan, wasn't in use in the days of Abraham. It wasn't in use in the days of Moses. This is a name that came into being much later. No, they were wrong. That name was in use before the time of Abraham. That's a very old name, and the Bible reflects accurately the world that it is depicting. About 150 of these tablets, and I learned after I made this slide that the thousands that were reported in some descriptions of them actually amounted to about 2,500 tablets altogether, once you'd put the pieces together of the broken ones and so forth, about 2,500 tablets. And about 150 of those tablets are literary tablets. By the way, it's been pointed out to me that it's a mistake to put so many words up on slides like this, and I knew that before I made the slides. It's just that I don't know how to say things without words sometimes, and so I use them, in spite of the fact that it may not be the best possible approach to getting the message across. I know sometimes when I'm standing here talking, you're sitting there reading, and that's okay. Just feel free. Go ahead. and sit there and read. Because if you weren't reading this, you'd probably be reading something else anyway. And at least this way, it's on topic. So about 150 of these tablets are literary tablets. The rest of them are archival records, records of transactions, records of property ownership, things like that. One of the things that these tablets do, they have the names of various deities, some 500 deities named, including the name Dagon, the name Baal, the name El, and I also learned the name Yah, Y-A, which is the shortened form of Yahweh, Jehovah, that we have in the Bible. Now, one of the common ideas that's out there is all religion originates, and I believe that when the name El turns up at Eblah, and when it turns up in the account of Melchizedek talking to Abraham, and when it turns up in the archives of the Canaanites, that they worshiped El as the greatest god for a long time, historically, that they knew the one God. And it was only over a period of time that they gradually moved away from the worship of one God to the worship of many deities. I've read a lot of mythology in my life, both ancient and modern mythology. And when I read mythology, on the one hand, it is far removed from Scripture. The quality is utterly different. But on the other hand, I very often see threads of truth that have survived in mythology. And you don't have to read with a terribly critical eye to see that that is the case. And when we have the name El included here in these old Eblah tablets, I personally have no doubt that this name, which is God in the Hebrew language, El, or in the plural form, Elohim, this name, which is God in the Hebrew language, reflects a continued knowledge of God, although it is diminishing day by day and year by year. And that has been discussed somewhat in previous programs that have been put on here. One of the other things that these Eblah tablets do is that of 8,000 Hebrew words in the Bible, there are 1,700 words that occur only once. And sometimes, like the word Pim, you don't know for sure what that word meant. But when you can look at other ancient documents that have word lists in them, and some of the Eblah tablets are word lists, it can give you insights into what those words originally meant in cases where they may be a little bit obscure. There also were psalms among the literary tablets at Eblah, and I wanted to share one of those with you. A psalm from Eblah reads, "Lord of heaven and earth, the earth was not, you created it. The light of day was not, you created it. The morning light you had not yet made exist." Now, was there a little residual truth hanging around here that the writer of that psalm at Eblah had in mind? Was he thinking about the Creator God that we read about in the writings of Moses? I have a notion that he was. I can't prove that, but I have a notion that he was, that that truth had not been utterly lost. When we move along further down the line in history, I'm not going to say very much about Ramses here today. I mentioned Ramses in the slideshow I did yesterday afternoon. I do want to mention once again that there have been some real problems in archaeology with establishing an accurate chronology for Israel and aligning it with Egypt. Egypt has such a big role to play in the story of Israel that in the 19th century, when interest in Egyptology, a lot of treasure hunters wanted to go find stuff in the deserts of Egypt, you know, and Egyptology grew into a sort of a science which had a lot to do with the science of archaeology. Among the kinds of things that came out of those 19th century effort were a couple of assumptions. And those assumptions especially involved two pharaohs. And I'm only going to mention this right now. I'm going to talk a little bit more about it on another occasion, but not very much about it. In the account of Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, we're told that he wasn't very good about following the Lord, and so Shishak, the Pharaoh of Egypt, was roused up by the Lord, and he came to Jerusalem, and he carried away all of the gold that was there in the temple and all the treasury that belonged to Rehoboam and the people of Jerusalem there. In the 19th century, when these fellows were down there looking at all these Egyptian hieroglyphics and things, they came across a name that looked a lot like Shishak. It's Shishonk. And they looked at that and they said, well, we have found the Shishak of the Bible. We know now which pharaoh it was that invaded Jerusalem. And since we have a pretty good idea of when that invasion took place from other sources, they decided that the right place and time for this pharaoh, Shishonk, was this time period when Rehoboam was the king, about 912 BC or somewhere in that time frame. So they put this Pharaoh there. And then, of course, the Bible mentions that the slaves that Moses led out of Egypt, before he led them out, they were building store cities for the Pharaoh. Does anybody remember the names of the store cities?
Python and Ramses.
Python and Ramses. And so people look and they say, okay, they were building Ramses, therefore Ramses must have been the Pharaoh. Well, that doesn't follow at all. And if we had the time, I would get into that in some detail today, but I don't. But that doesn't follow at all. There are numerous examples where at a later time, the name was updated so that a current generation would understand what it is they're reading about. And that is almost certainly the case with the name Ramses. Although the area could have been called Ramses previous to the placement of the Pharaoh Ramses II. But that's probably not even the case at all. The place probably was later called Ramses, and then the name was ascribed to the place where the Israelites were building those cities. I'm not going to get into it right now, but those assumptions that we could align the history of Israel with these two events, Ramses at the Exodus and Shishak, the Egyptian Pharaoh Shishak, at the invasion of Jerusalem, have caused all kinds of problems in setting in order the chronology of Israel. That when the archaeologists were working back past about the 8th century BC, there are always questions about what they're really looking at, about what it is that they're actually exposing. Now, back to about the 8th century BC, we have plenty of other evidence to put things in place. But back past the 8th century BC, it starts being a little bit more iffy as to the kinds of things that they are putting in chronological order. Faulty assumptions produce faulty conclusions. You probably cannot appreciate the humor of this cartoon, but I'll share it with you anyway. I'm sure that you can't read what it says. It's got a picture of two fellows producing jugs, big storage jars. One of them is turning a jar on a wheel, and it's not really the right kind of thing for him to be doing with that kind of jar, but one of them's turning a jar on a wheel, and the other one is standing there and saying to him, "Hey Sam, why are you still making those late Bronze 2B storage jars? Don't you know it's now Iron 1?" If you don't understand that, it's okay, but the chronology of human history is broken up into assigned ages. And the idea here is that this guy's making the wrong kind of pottery for the age that he's supposed to be living in. And the illustration that I would offer to you, which is an extreme illustration, is suppose that an archaeologist comes on the scene in America in 2500, 500 years down the line from now, and that radical changes have taken place and the civilization of America has been essentially destroyed, and not much is known about the civilization of America. And so he settles on a site in Pennsylvania where there used to be a community, and he wonders what kind of a community was this and where should he date it. And as he digs, he begins to find various artifacts, and what we know, looking from our perspective, is that the place where he's digging is an Amish community. Now, is he going to get an accurate picture of American life by digging in this Amish community? Is he going to be able to successfully date that based on his sketchy information about the American past? Is he going to be able to put that in proper perspective? I think the answer to most of those questions is no. He's not going to be able to get that straight very well. And those are some of the kinds of problems that archaeologists do face in dealing with very old artifacts, with very old periods of time, very old levels. Hey, there used to be a line there and it disappeared. I wanted to bring a couple of dates to your attention that are pretty well fixed. One is that in 70 AD, Jerusalem was destroyed. That's no surprise. You've heard about that. The Romans invaded and destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD. In 30 AD, and I'll say here plus or minus 1 year, 33 just won't really work out, but in 30 AD, plus or minus 1 year, Jesus was crucified. And I think 30 is probably the best reasonable date for that, but plus or minus 1 year. In 586 BC, Jerusalem was destroyed by the Babylonians, and people were taken away in captivity to Babylon. That date is very firmly fixed. In 970 BC, Solomon became king. Now, that date is based on the work of a man named Thiel. His book is referred to in the notes that are in your binder, and it's as good a book as I know of on the chronology of the Israelite kings, the kings of Israel and Judah. And he establishes by his very careful critical reasoning, looking at the biblical text, a date of about 970 BC for the beginning of Solomon's reign. And if we look then at 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 1, we see that the temple began to be built in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, and that was 480 years after the Israelites had left Egypt, which gives us a pretty close date for when the Israelites left Egypt in 1447 BC, a pretty good date for when the Israelites left Egypt. The next date is a little more tricky, because this is one of those places where we might not be absolutely certain what the original text says. If we look at Exodus chapter 12 and verse 41, we're told that it had been 430 years from the time that the Israelites either entered Canaan or else entered Egypt until the time when they went out following Moses. If you follow the Septuagint, it was from the time when they had come into, the time they had spent in Canaan and Egypt. If you follow the Masoretic text, it's the time they spent in Egypt. So 1877 is either the time of Joseph going into Egypt, or the family of Jacob, really, or else it's the time of Abraham coming into Canaan. Paul seems to indicate that it's the time of Abraham coming into Canaan in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 17. But we have those as kind of pegs that we can hang things on from a biblical perspective. And because of a time problem, I'm going to skip right past the discussion of Ramses and Dan and Bethel and how names were brought up to date in various time periods, because I want to just mention Jericho, and that's all it will be, is just mentioning Jericho. Jericho is a site that has been excavated several times since 1867. It's been excavated three more times in this century by different archaeologists. And I'm not going to take the time to discuss the diagram that was up there. There is an article on this. No, there's not an article on this over here. Instead of the article on this, I'm going to jump right to this slide. And I think I have a web page you can go look at if you really want to, that deals with this subject. For those of you who have internet connections, when we go to Jericho, we find that there is a lot of controversy over what the archaeologists have turned up there. That is to say, when John Garstang excavated there in the 1930s, he said, this is biblical Jericho. He looked at what is called City 4, a particular level of ruins at Jericho, because there have been many levels of habitation at Jericho. And he said, what we've got here at City 4 is exactly what the Bible describes. He says, in 1400 BC, which is the right time for Joshua to be coming into the land of Canaan, in 1400 BC, this city was destroyed. The walls fell down. Apparently, there was an earthquake, and the walls fell down. The city was burned with fire. All the food was still here. Nothing was looted. Everything was left in place. There had not been any lengthy period of siege because the jars were still full of food. All of the storage jars were still full of food. And all of the evidence, he said, points to exactly the kind of thing that was described in the Bible. And then about 20 years later, a young archaeologist named Kathleen Kenyon went to the same place and did a small dig. And she came back with conclusions that said, well, you know, that's not right. She said, this city was destroyed in 1550 BC, about 150 years earlier than Garstang said. And so his conclusions are no good. In fact, at the time of Joshua, she said, there was no city here at all. There wasn't any city here in the time of Joshua. And so she rejected his findings. And then we can come along down the line and look at interpretations of others, including Bryant Wood, who's got a web page here that's listed on the top of this screen. And he goes back and he says, okay, looking at Kathleen Kenyon's notes, looking at her diagrams, looking at her drawings, Garstang was right about some of it, but not about all of it. But he still comes back to the conclusion that the exact biblical scenario is met. But what's more important, he comes back to the conclusion it was about 1400 BC. And then another guy named David Rawl, who is an Egyptologist, comes and looks at it, and he doesn't follow the same line of reasoning as Bryant Wood. He follows a very different line of reasoning, but he still comes to the conclusion that it was in about 1400 BC that City 4 was destroyed. Now, I say those things to you because this, as I say, is kind of a banner example of the kinds of things that happen in the archaeology of very old things in the land of Israel, as well as in other places. Now, I have every confidence that the description that we have in Joshua 6 is exactly right. And everything that I have read from the writings of Kenyon and Garstang and Wood and Rawl convinced me that, in fact, city for, yes, that is the place that Joshua destroyed. That's right. And it happened just the way it says in the Bible. Now, they have problems with establishing the chronology, but that's where the problems are, is in establishing the chronology. Problems with figuring out the dating by looking at pottery and various other kinds of evidence, because they have made some mistakes in trying to sort out the chronology prior to the 8th century B.C. But we see Jericho here built up on a wall. That wall is 15 feet high, made of stone, and behind it is a dirt fill, an earthen fill. It wouldn't do you any good to break into that wall because you wouldn't be into anything once you got into it. Above that, you had this earthen fill that slopes back to a wall here, and on top of it, you have a wall made of clay bricks. This slope has been plastered over so that erosion will not carry away the earthen fill or wash it down against the earthen wall, the wall of mud brick that's been built here. This would be the area where the lower class people of the city lived. Up here would be the area behind the second wall where the upper class people of the city would live. Which of those two would a woman named Rahab live in? The lower. And that's what we have described for us biblically, is that she lived on the wall. And she literally lived on the wall, because with this revetment wall, this wall that stood 15 feet high with the earthen fill, she literally had a house built on the wall, which is what the archaeological evidence shows to be the case, that there was this kind of a wall there. The evidence also shows that because of some kind of a disruption, the mud brick walls fell down. And not just as illustrated here, that's for purposes of illustration. They really fell down. And when they fell down, contrary to providing a defense to the people inside, they provided access to the people outside, because they didn't have to climb that 15 feet steep wall. They had ramps. Ramps made of mud bricks that fell from the walls above. When the mud brick walls fell down, they provided the access so that every man could go straight in, as described in the Bible. That's what you have at the archaeological scene. Inside the city, you have all of these things that should have been either carried away by the people who won the battle, or else have been consumed by the people who were there under siege if the siege had lasted very long. But what you find is that everything is there. It just was left there. Jars full of food were left there. But they didn't survive intact because the whole place was burned. And so you have jars full of charred grain. It's right after the harvest has taken place. The jars are full. And that's exactly the time of year that Israel came in. It is at the time right after Passover, just when the harvest of the winter grain crop has been brought in, that this thing took place. Everything about Jericho says this is exactly what's described in the sixth chapter of Joshua, except the uncertainty of the archaeologists about the date, whether it's 1400 B.C. or 1550 B.C. The only problem that exists in interpreting the story of Jericho is figuring out the date of the destruction. Everything about the destruction, including a long abandonment during which the mud bricks turned into mud, were washed into a layer of red and kind of jumbled all together, a long period of exposure and erosion, all of these things exactly fitting into the biblical account of what took place at Jericho. Now, this is exactly how far I got when I went a couple minutes over time in the young adult class today, too, and I did it very altogether differently in here, but I still couldn't get past this point. So a total of about 14 slides is about all a guy can do, and there's just no help for it. I do actually have some things about Jericho. I said earlier I had an article, and I said, no, I don't have an article, and I don't. I just have some things that I collected about Jericho, which I also will set over here on the table if anyone wants to look at those and think about it a little bit more. I would have liked to have had time to talk about Nineveh, but Nineveh would have been a session all in and of itself, testifying yet again to the fact that where history has been lost and forgotten, information has been put to the side, and the uncertainties of the scholars have come to the fore, that the Bible has been demonstrated to be a true and accurate record of things that have taken place in the past, including some rather inexplicable things. You know, when they excavated Nineveh in the 19th century, they found records there that went back to events that are recorded in the Bible, including when Sennacherib had Jerusalem under siege. And that is recounted for us in the books of Kings and Isaiah, when Sennacherib had Hezekiah and the city of Jerusalem under siege. 2 Kings chapter 18 and Isaiah chapter 36 give us the account there, and how Isaiah promised Hezekiah that the siege would be broken, that God would intervene in behalf of the people of Judah. Now, that is recorded, that is to say, the siege of Jerusalem is recorded in the annals of Sennacherib on the walls of his palace in Nineveh. And it is recorded that he had Hezekiah shut up in Jerusalem like a bird in a cage. It is not recorded that he left Jerusalem without destroying the city. That is a fact. He left Jerusalem without destroying the city. And that is without parallel in the history of Assyrian conquest. There is no parallel to the survival of Jerusalem in 701 BC when Hezekiah was the king and Isaiah the prophet said, "You will survive. God will deliver you." Sennacherib didn't explain why he broke off the siege and went home. He doesn't explain what it was that caused him to abandon the siege of Jerusalem. But we do know that it's the only time that it ever happened. There was no parallel for it in any of the exploits of Sennacherib or his predecessors in their efforts to conquer the enemy. God promised Hezekiah that he would deliver him. The Bible records that. The Assyrian Chronicles confirm that God did deliver him, but without ever giving actual credit to God or explaining the circumstances that took place there. God has said that he will deliver us. God has said that he will bring us into his very presence with a gift of eternal life. And as surely as God delivered Jerusalem from the power of Sennacherib, he will deliver us from the power of Satan. God is able to bring about victory or defeat. If we choose to align ourselves with him, then victory is assured. We're going to sing a song of invitation. Emery Wright has the song for us. And while we sing, if anyone needs to embrace the victory that is ours through Jesus Christ, you can be assured that God will do his part and will give you everlasting life. Let's stand together and sing the song that Emery has chosen.